Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, it's Flo, and this is my impression of someone calling into Sports Talk Radio.
Yeah, this is Flo, longtime caller, first time on air. I just wanted to say that I think it is absolute hogwash not to go out there and try Progressive's Name Your Price tool. You could see all your coverage options, and options are how you get rings. Championship rings. And parades of rings.
Finding options to fit your budget with the Name Your Price tool. Only at Progressive.com.
You know, not for nothing, but my favorite rings have candy on them.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
All right. Welcome to the Real Sports Guys, where real guys talk real sports. This is your guy, D. Wills, in the building. We normally have my guy, Marcus the Game Changer, but, you know, the thing about being the kind of folks we are and the families and everything else, you know, this is that, you know, that college onboarding season, and so he's moving his daughter into the residence hall, and, you know, we have these kind of responsibilities. We value education. So this is a really important time for him and the family as they have their daughter going on to college. So we definitely want to have him share that experience when he's back with us on the next podcast. But as usual, I got my other guy, even though we don't have three in the booth. You know, sometimes we can go two on three. We can do that. We got the kind of skills like that. And I got my guy, Phil, PhD, in the building. How you doing, guy?
I'm doing good, man. But let me be clear. When I'm going 2-on-3, that means I'm too out of shape and I just can't run up and down, so I'll just stay back on defense.
That's all we're doing. We'll spread the court because one thing, you and I got some range, so we can space the floor. So you step off, you know, we will pull up and fall out of bounds on you and may call glass on you.
Yeah.
We'll be looking for oxygen, but we will call glass on you.
Funny story, man. I remember my last year in college, I was playing basketball 3 or 4 days a week. I was playing with Marcus and the guys on the basketball team and their open gym off the, you know, off season stuff. And so, you know, I was in pretty good shape, man. But then that first job after undergrad, you know, that first year, I'm not working out. You got money. You can eat whenever you want to. And the next time I played basketball was probably like a year after that. Man, I nearly fell. I nearly killed myself because I was going at it, you know, like it was a year before, but my body was telling me, you need to slow down. Talk about oxygen. I've never felt my heart beat that fast, ever.
You start getting that. I mean, I was telling folks until – for a long time, I would play 3 and 4 times a week, and I remember I woke up and thought about it, and I hadn't played in like 2 weeks. I had never gone any time in my life not playing basketball at least 3 or 4 times, and I just knew I wasn't going to make it back. Never came back. Like, it wasn't going to happen. But I was trying to make intramural. I was a staff member trying to make intramural all-star teams and everything else. It was the great experience about being at the place we call Beloit College. And you know, we're going to have that theme tonight. One of the things that we like to do, we're a national show. We usually hit some national and sometimes international issues. But there are times when we want to, you know, kind of narrow in and still kind of have that national focus. But there are times we always want to reconnect, especially for the three of us, with our alma mater. And so we got a special show tonight. We got the authors of Deprived, the Lost 1982 NFL Season. Jimmy Grant and Sean Miskivens, the authors, will be with us tonight. They are two former Division III athletes, but now turned authors. And, you know, for many of us, you know, we experienced that 1982 in many different ways. But they have a fabulous book. You can get a copy of it or learn more about it if you go to realsportsguys.com. Check out, we have an Amazon carousel, and you'll see the book there. Click on it. It'll take you right to it, learn more about it. But it's a must read. We'll have a chance for Jimmy to talk about his quarterback rating system, which is pretty interesting, and his reasons why he developed his own system, given the quarterback rating system we currently have, and the way in which folks look at it. ESPN has really been pushing that a lot. And so we got a great show. Phil and I will be hitting it hard, talking about a little bit of NFL. We'll be hitting on some of the college football issues. We have a whole bunch of stuff. Some of you, if you listened to our last podcast, we made our predictions, so we might hit back a little bit with that and kind of get a sense of where we are now with that. But before we get into the interview, I got some things on my big board. And I got this big board, and I'll probably, you know, it's not like Mel's big board. I'll probably do something on Twitter, take a picture of it. But I got a couple things I put on my big board. The one thing is RG3 is on my big board, and I've been trying to understand. I was just talking to Phil about this before we came on, we went on the air. I'm trying to understand the RG3 situation, and there are times when criticize Daniel Snyder. I mean, he's usually the focus of most of the criticism when things don't go well in Washington. But on this one, I've got to give the owner a pass. On this one, I got to give him a pass. I blame this situation on all the football operations people, from the Shanahan regime and now the Gruden regime. The Shanahans, in terms of how they handled him post-season one and really worked with him on that. Yes, there's some things that he probably needs to do from a maturity standpoint, but I think there's ways in which they handled him in ways in which other elite quarterbacks with his status, they would not have handled him that way. And I think Gruden made what I call the mistake that a lot of, really, what I would say, first-time head coaches make. They spend so much time trying to put in their program that they're not really scanning for how their talent sometimes fits into it. So I think Gruden came in trying to really establish some authority with him in a way that created a chasm in a way I didn't think he had to. And it was from the first time I saw it, I felt like this is not going to head anywhere. Not because RG3 couldn't, but Gruden wasn't doing the kind of things that are going to help him be successful because he was too busy trying to make a point. You know, if he said something, he would put him back in his place. And just those kind of dynamics that I was just clear up front was not going to work. And so now what do we do? You know, they're probably going to cut him, and then he's going to part his ways, and then we're going to go with Kirk Cousins. And the backup quarterback is always the person that everybody's clamoring for. You know, everybody talk about the backup quarterback and what they're going to do. And now we got another one like Kirk Cousins, who he wasn't impressive at all, but somehow because he kind of says the right things, you know, we're going to figure out that we can give him a chance because, you know, he practices the way we want to. I feel like, you know, I want to come out with some of my own things. Sometimes I feel like, is AI right? You know, because folks want to just come out with their own stuff and try to talk about the way in which, you know, he's practicing and his approach and everything that comes along with that. And sometimes I just
listen. We're talking about practice, not a game, not a game, not a game. We're talking about practice.
We talking about practice. I hear people say, well, he practices, he does all these different things. And some of that is okay, but it's not kinds of stuff that leads you to championships. And RG3 has a special arm, had special skills. But this whole concept of developmental approach to quarterbacking, you know, it's going to be great to even talk to Jimmy and Sean a little bit about this, that, you know, even the when you talk about the quarterbacks in 1982 or those eras, you know, some of the things when you read their book, you know, you also get a sense of how coaches and organizations try to develop quarterbacks. Even quarterbacks you didn't think were going to be great, they develop quarterbacks, or veteran quarterbacks that, like a person like Ken Anderson, who late in his career, or Plunkett, who were able to revitalize their career, could do it because organizations understood that there's this developmental process that's part of it. And I think that's lost today. And I think we've lost a lot of talent because coaches and organizations don't have that approach. And so I got RG3 on my big board. The other person I have on my big board, just on the opposite side of it, is Serena Williams. Oh, my goodness. I mean, she won that first match. If you left and gone to the store and had to get you something to eat, you know, usually tennis matches will last an hour, hour and a half, maybe 2 hours. You come back, it's over. I mean, it was like she was practicing by herself. I mean, Serena is on a mission. I don't know if it was, you know, straight out of Compton came out. She got hyped and felt like she was rejuvenated. I don't know what it is, but she came out strong, came through the building, just crushing it, and is going to try to run that cycle again. And you got to start talking about her in terms of being the greatest tennis player of all time and one of the greatest athletes. I mean, I think the way in which she's changed the game in a lot of different ways, and there's been a lot of discussions about on the air around the fact that given her greatness, you know, has she benefit in terms of the financial benefits from sponsorships in the way she should have. And I think that's a conversation we need to think about. I mean, when you think about how far the Williams had, the sisters had to come, when you coming from the environment they had to come from to get to where they are now and the determination, you know, there's a story there. And I think marketing and everything else is about a storyline. And to not be able to find ways for her to benefit, you know, those are things that would be, you know, are very important in terms of how we look at her. But she has just been incredible, and you know, I'm just excited to see her, you know, do what she's doing now. In some ways, I felt like, you know, I wish we would have been able to appreciate her more, because I think that, you know, she has done something incredible. And I think as we reflect on her career and her greatness, you know, we're gonna think we had somebody who is you know, one of the greatest athletes, you know, male, female, we've seen. I mean, she does things on the court that I think even, you know, her male counterparts are saying, wow, you know, she is doing her thing. And then the third person on my board, just because they can't stop talking about him, is my guy Tom Brady. You know, I grew up in Michigan, Ann Arbor, watched Brady, loved him. But he can't just get away from this stuff. As much as he probably wants to get away from it, he got to fight it. He's still in the middle of this. We're going to over some deflated balls. We in court systems. You know, Roger Goodell, you know, the habitual line stepper, is pushing this thing to the limit. I mean, from an NFL standpoint, there's, you know, sometimes people say all publicity is good publicity, but this is run its course. It's taken away, I think, from the game in a way that it needs to. This has kind of run its course to people being tired about it. You know, Bounty Gate that had this kind of intrigue that kind of held a little bit. This thing lost its luster a long time ago, and there should be some owners who just want to let this thing go. And I'm hoping that, you know, I know we're seeking some resolution here pretty soon, but I want to take this off my big board, but I can't, because everywhere I turn, you got drawings of him. You know, first he's looking old, then they kind of corrected that, and now I got him looking somewhere near what he's trying to do. You know, everything. Now they're talking about his drawings, the drawings of him in the court. I mean, they're trying to milk this thing for everything they can get. And I think this is a time where it's kind of having a negative hit on the NFL, and the fact that, you know, you can't spend all your time in the courts and not have people start to wonder what's going on. So, you know, Roger Goodell's got to win this one, because if he doesn't, there are going to be some problems. You know, the owner's going to have to do something. At some point, owners have to think this contentious relationship with the players is not going to be good for long running. So they got to find a way either to smooth this out. You know, when something like this ends up in the court, that means that there's something deeper happening between the NFLPA, the players, and the NFL. And Roger Goodell was one of those main things. And now you got some owners who are split on the way he's handling business. So, you know, when you try to mess with the, you know, the number one guy, the number one stunner, Tom Brady, you know, that everybody loves, that has reached beyond the game, that opens up something new. So, you know, I'm excited and ready to go. And, you know, we have some great, great stuff to talk about tonight. And I'm looking forward to having my guys who are here to meet me tonight, Jimmy and Sean, talk about their book, because I think it's going to be a fun time. And, you know, we're going to be hitting some really good stuff here, talking about the 1982 strike, because I think a lot of stuff that we're seeing today has a lot of connection to, you know, what happened back then and this relationship that continues to happen with the Players Association, the players in the league. And, you know, this goes back a long time. And before some of you folks who are listening to us, you know, even fell in love with the game, these issues have impacted us in ways that that kind of control how things are going right now. So we're going to come back in a few minutes. We're going to talk to our authors, and we're going to have some fun tonight. And thank you again for being with us. Real Sports Guys, go to realsportsguys.com. You can definitely check out this book, The Pride, The Lost 1982 Season, NFL Season, to check it out yourself. But when I come back, we'll have our authors, Jimmy Grant and Sean Miskivens, on the air with us.
You're listening to The Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, brought to you by Resistance Digital Solutions. You're listening to The Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, brought to you by Resistance Digital Solutions.
All right, welcome back to The Real Sports Guys, where real guys talk real sports.
You're listening to The Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, brought to you by Resistance Digital Solutions.
Yes, there we go. I'm mixing like the cut creator right now. We're back on. We're ready. You know, I'm doing the voiceovers. I'm cutting up tonight. I will get my turntables going. I got my boy Phil T back in the building, but I'm excited right now because these are two guys that that I know, and it was interesting when I was reading their book. I, you know, because I've heard them talk and tell stories, I could almost hear them talking to me, which was great. And they're great storytellers. But it also made me kind of reflect back on my own childhood and, you know, and how I felt about that time. And I love the way they approached their book in terms of integrating their own kind of upbringing and family culture into even thinking about the what ifs. And so it's something that I definitely encourage you to check out. You can get their book. If you go to realsportsguys.com, we have an Amazon carousel right there at the top of the page. Click to it. The material helps us to really kind of understand some of what we see in the NFL today and where some of the origin of some of the contention, as I was just talking about with Brady, where some of that stuff comes from. It also reflects and lets you know a little bit about, you know, the history and some lost stories that people should really know about. And so it's great to have on the air with us Jimmy Grant and Sean Miskimmins, the authors of Deprived, the Lost 1982 NFL Season. Hey, gentlemen, thanks for being here tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this, and I had a chance to read the book, and, you know, part of it is, you know, as someone who's worked on writing projects with others, you know, I guess, and Jimmy, I'll direct this to you first. First of all, you know, how did this idea come about? You know, where did it come from? Can you talk a little bit about that and why you decided to write this book?
You know, it's funny. We, as far back as being younger in college, we used to always joke about writing a book together about football because, you know, we're both, I mean, I'm a high school history teacher. I'm a football coach. You know, Sean's a high school history teacher, and we just like history, and I love NFL history. And so we started kicking around ideas, and, like, I love the 82, like, the games I remember pretty well. My first Super Bowl was 14 because we lived near Pittsburgh at the time, and that was the Steelers' last of their first run. But I really started getting football in, like, the 80 season. And so 82, you know, you're starting to get really into it. And then the strike hits, and you realize that as a kid, there's a lot of business involved in all this. It's not just a game. And so that season always fascinated me. And I just thought about, like, you know, how would the season have played out differently if there hadn't been a strike? And so I think that was sort of the inspiration for it. And I love that era of football. I want to say from, like, you know, 70 to, you know, 85, 86, that's probably my favorite era. And so it just stuck out as something I thought was interesting and kind of maybe a forgotten story.
That's a period that I came of age in. So I do resonate that. Sean, you going to add something to that?
Yeah. If I could just add something, you know, part of, you know, when you're a history major, it's not like math or science where there's a lot of questions where there is, you know, a direct correct answer and that's it. That's the only choice. So I think part of our training in college was to think outside the box and look at alternatives to different sorts of questions. So, you know, and Jimmy hit it on the head. That is our favorite era of the NFL. You know, a lot of those guys, you know, some guys we just miss, like I miss Staubach. I never saw him play, but, you know, he was a name that was thrown out. And then there's all these guys that were great in the early 80s. And I think when we said we wanted to do this, it was like, well, let's feed our passion. Let's feed, you know, something from the 70 to 85 time period of NFL. And I've always been a big bookstore browser and, you know, looking at history books and sports books. And, you know, so part of me was like, well, what's something that, like, can be really analyzed? What's something that can be, like, retold? And, you know, a lot of people listening right now that might have an interest in the NFL, I'm sure they remember the 87 strike. Well, only three games played with the scab players and one game was missed. So the bulk of that season was played. 12 of the 16 games were played. In 82, you barely had half the season played. You had nine. And then they switched the playoff format. So it's just like, it was so built for, like, a, boy, we lost a lot of stuff here. What exactly would have happened if they'd played the whole 16-game season and the regular playoff format? So that what-if history thing in us, it kind of took hold.
And, I mean, you both talked about it, and you both, you know, you both play college football, and but you also have this kind of, you know, this growth that you had in terms of your academic passion for history. You know, how did that, you know, as athletes and this kind of pursuit of your other passion, how did that also inform this process? Jimmy, I'll let you go with that one. Or Sean, take it.
Go ahead, Sean.
You know, I remember Jimmy was one of the first people, once we got out of college, to talk about being a lifelong learner. And I wasn't into education back then in terms of I had my history degree, but I didn't have my educational teaching certificate yet. So I was kind of like, well, what does that mean? And he's like, it means that you're constantly cultivating your academics. You're learning new things. You're taking classes. Maybe you're getting advanced degrees. And so, you know, as I first jumped into the museum field being a curator before I became a history teacher, like there was a lot of opportunities I had all of a sudden where I was writing things and I was publishing things. And, you know, I remember, you know, we're in the early days of school right now, so we're going over like the regiments in my class and I'm giving out my syllabus and I'm telling them, okay, you're going to write research papers this year. And I was like, I used to be excited when somebody would say, you get to write a research paper and you get to pick the topic, so long as it comes under the heading of this class. So kind of when we were coming up with the idea for the book, it was like, we want something from, you know, what we would call vintage NFL of our childhood. And then, you know, we get a chance to delve into books and libraries and go to the index and look what we're looking for. And, okay, I got to go to this website. I got to get this newspaper. I've always liked doing research and then historical analysis. So whether it's actual, like, military history, like World War II, or it's baseball or football history, you know, I got a whole bookshelf just of, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s NFL and Major League Baseball books. I love history and I love sports history. So, it was a fun task, just like writing something to be published about, you know, the Air Force in like a local magazine or for a local periodical that I've done. It was that sort of fun. I love research.
Yeah, and, you know, and I had written early in my coaching career, I had an article published in a coaching periodical. And when I wrote it, I'm like, I doubt they'll print this. And then they did, and I had three or four other ones published, and I was like, wow, I mean, you know, I always liked to write. I always liked, you know, as Sean said, that research kind of process. And I'm like, you know, if I can have something published in that small format, you know, let's see if we can do it in a bigger format and see how it turns out. It was sort of like just a fun project, you know, to work on. And so, you know, you just kind of figured, you know, let's give this thing a shot and see if we can do it.
Jimmy, I'm going to continue with you, and Sean didn't jump in. You know, when you write stuff like this, you're doing research, you're getting a lot of stuff. You know, in the co-writing process, you know, you kind of have to decide some things. So how did y'all decide what was going to go in the book, and then what ended up on the cutting floor that was interesting that, you know, if you had to write it again or write something else that you would include?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because we did have to do a lot of collaboration. And I think one of the things that you had to watch, I guess, is that, you know, there was, I think we picked like five games that were compelling games that didn't get played. Well, that's such a narrow number. There was probably 20 really, I mean, and in the course of an NFL season, there's a couple different compelling games every week. But you start looking at that and you're like, for the ordinary person that picks this up, that's not like a football, like, stat, like, junkie, you know, they're going to be, you know, through that third game and be like, all right, this is boring. I get it. Games were missed, you know. So we had to sit there and kind of narrow that down because you just get to the point where it would become like a, you know, a Reader's Digest of pretend football games didn't happen. So that was something that while I was interested in it, I'm like, you know, I don't know that the average reader will want to read more than a few of these. So for me, that would have been something that I left on, I would say, you know, so to speak, left on the cutting room floor. So that was something for me. Sean?
There's a couple things that, you know, as we got into the 82 strike, of course, you know, we remember the 87 strike. There was a near strike in 1970, and there was a short strike in 1974. And to be honest, I didn't know much about the 74 strike. We go into that a little bit in the book. I knew nothing. I didn't know there had almost been a strike in 1970, and it's funny. And that got left on the cutting room floor because basically some of the issues they were upset with then got hammered out to a small extent. And then in 74, you know, things changed and they were coming to a head again. And that kind of led into the 82 strike. So that was covered more. But so some of the stuff in the 1970 strike that almost happened was left on the cutting room floor. I mean, it was interesting because different people years later said things like, I remember Mel Renfro saying like, and Cornell Green, a couple of the Dallas D-backs from that era, were like, it was stupid when we talked about having a strike. We had it at the start of training camp. You know, the owners had plenty of time to, you know, come up with something, and, you know, we should have struck right at the regular season. I think one of them even said something like, we should have struck the day of the first game. Like, we should have told them we're not coming out of the locker room unless this happens or whatever. You know, basically, like, it would have given us more leverage, but people weren't united. And I think something that you will get if you read the book, and this basically probably goes back from, like, the late 80s all the way back, is NFL players were not paid that much money, and they needed that job. A lot of guys had jobs in the offseason all the way up to the mid to late 80s. So they weren't working because it was fun or they didn't get along with their wife. They needed that income. So if you have a job in the off season to help support yourself, you're going to be missing your paycheck. You're going to be struggling at home. So, I mean, it was very abundantly clear that, like, you know, the NFL of today making hand over fist money was not the NFL of 30 or 35 years ago.
And y'all talk a little bit about that book, because even though there's more money in the game, when you think about it from, you know, proportionally, some of those issues around lack of guaranteed contracts for players, some of that stuff where compared to their peers, they're still struggling with, even though the game has gotten bigger. And we'll get into to some of that. Jimmy, I want to, from the research, I don't know if you had a chance to interview people or I think Sean just touched on a little bit of this, but, you know, was there something that you learned that you didn't know prior to research, or did you have a chance to talk to anyone that just hit you with a story or something that kind of blew you away?
Well, I'll let Sean take this, because he actually got to talk to someone. The guy that I was slated to talk to, it was going to be Bradshaw, and he stiffed a card show that we were going to go to and have a chance to talk to him. But Sean got to talk to Darryl Grant, who was a really good player on the 82 Redskins. And so I'll let him talk about that a little bit, about what, you know, his analysis of that was. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, when I met Darryl Grant, I had a chance to talk to him for a few moments casually. And, you know, for those, you know, like Phil, you know, I was a Cowboys fan. We didn't have a pro team where I grew up in Oregon. So, you know, the Cowboys were on TV all the time. You know, they had some glamorous players. It was fun to watch people like Drew Pearson and Tony Dorsett. And so I remember watching the 82 NFC Championship, and I remember basically Darryl Grant salted the game away when he caught a batted Gary Hogaboom pass and took it into the end zone from about 12 yards out to push it from 24-17 Redskins to 31-17 at RFK. So he obviously was an integral part of that Redskin team that got to the Super Bowl that year. And, you know, in the research in the book, you know, prior to that NFC Championship game, Dallas had really had Washington's number for a pretty good period of time. Now, there were some tight games. It wasn't like they were ripping them, but Dallas had a pretty good, you know, 8-1, 7-1 the last eight games against Washington. They had even won that year in RFK. You know, Washington won 8-1 during the strike season. They lost at home to Dallas. So when I interviewed Darryl Grant, I said, you know, you guys had lost to them at home. They had kind of beaten you a lot recently. You know, was psychologically, was that in the back of your mind, you know? And what sort of lift did you guys get when you knocked Danny White out of the game? Because 82 was the only year Danny White, you know, who of course did a pretty decent job replacing Staubach. It's tough replacing a legend. That's the only year he went to the Pro Bowl, and the Skins knocked him out of that game. And so I said, you know, how did you guys feel on the sideline? The game was tight. It was the second quarter. You knocked him out. How did you feel? And he's like, oh, it was a tremendous lift psychologically. Whenever you knock a starting quarterback out of the game, that's a big deal. And, of course, like you said, Dallas did have our number. It was, you know, a huge psychological thing. We got this guy coming in we don't really know much about. He's a younger guy. And, you know, it just gave us a tremendous boost. Now, I don't really think Washington was, quote-unquote, in trouble at that point of the game when they knocked Danny White out. But, you know, as somebody that played football, and Devon, I know you played as well, something like that, you knock out a starting quarterback in a big game like that, like, I mean, you can remember the emotion and that sort of thing. Like, it gives you a lift. And, you know, obviously the Skins were trying to get to the Super Bowl for the first time in about 10 years, so I can imagine the lift that it gave them.
you know, one of the things in my big board conversation before I brought you on, one of the things I talked about is RG3 and at least this lack of thinking about how important it is to develop players, particularly at the quarterback position, this patience that you need to have to get folks like, you know, everybody's not going to come in like Andrew Luck and be ready made. And what was great about reading the book was these stories, when you think about Plunkett and you think about Anderson and some of these older guys who had the second life, but also, you know, and I love as two historians how y'all framed it, you know, because a reader today would read that book and y'all are really clear to talk about this because, you know, when you mention people like Montana, people go to what they know about him now, but y'all really as historians try to keep it in the context of 82 and understanding, I mean, when people understand, I mean, Walsh, one of his greatest things was thinking about the development of his quarterback and how y'all talked about players like Montana and, you know, how were you able to keep yourself in the moment and kind of defend against that? And what's your opinion around how some of these players developed and how, you know, what happened in 82 either stifled or helped development? I mean, y'all really tried to capture some of that as part of your book. Can you talk a little bit about that? Maybe I'll go with Jimmy and then and Sean and you jump in.
Well, I think that money changed everything. I really do, and not for the better. Now, if I was in the NFL, I would have said it changed it for the better. But I think it's really – and it's easy for us to sound old and say it's ruined the fabric of the game. We just sound like old people when we say that. But in a lot of ways, it really has. I mean, the one thing that Walsh had that was an advantage when he took over the 49ers, they were abysmal for so long that – you know, he drafts Montana. The quote he used is, before he got hurt, before Namath got hurt, he had incredible feet. And Walsh talked about Montana saying he had these nimble feet like Namath before he got hurt, and that's what attracted him, how good his feet were. Well, in today's day and age where, you know, these stadiums are huge, they need to be sold out, there's a bottom line, a coach now, they have a 2 to 3 year window. And if they don't turn it around, they're done. So a coach coming in that drafts RG3, he's not looking at a 5-year plan. It's a 2-year plan or a 3-year plan. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like gambling and saying, like, you know what? I'm gambling here. If he gets hurt, if he's not any good, I'm done. But if it takes me 5 years and I leave him on the bench, I'm going to develop him over a 5-year period, I'm not going to be here in 5 years. So I think the money really changed everything. There are so many guys. I mean, look at even with Marino, he didn't start right away. There was a little bit of a window where he sat before taking over for Woodley. That, you know, and I just feel like in today's day and age, they just can't afford to do that. And I think it's largely because of the money, that player development. It's such a win now mentality that if you don't, you know, it's just, there's just not a lot of job security. That's what it means to me anyway.
Well, you listen to Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com. I'm on with Jimmy Grant and Sean Miskivens, authors of Deprived, The Lost 1982 NFL Season. And we're talking about development. And Sean, I think you had something that you want to add to it. So go on and add something here to that conversation.
I mean, you asked, how did we stay in the moment? Again, like so many times as historians, like you're posed with a question about, well, this was horrific what they did. That's abysmal that army did that to that civilian population, that incident. And you're always trained like, well, you have to look at it somewhat differently than in 2015. You have to look at it in the context of their times. That's a big phrase that's thrown out in history. So I think, again, having that historian thing in us, we kind of look at it in the context of their time. So in 1982, Joe Montana is not this great, epic Hall of Fame quarterback. He's a young quarterback who showed some great potential. He got to a Super Bowl and he won it. And, like, he's still trying to cement his place as a solid NFL starter. He's still trying to stick with the franchise. I mean, you can throw out some names. You can go a little bit older or you can go a little bit younger. You know, Boomer Esiason is a young guy, took a Bengals team to the Super Bowl. Tony Eason got a Patriots team there that really had no business weaving through the AFC playoffs. You know, they never get back. They never become anything. You know, in Boomer's case, he's a Pro Bowler a couple times. I'm pretty sure Eason never made more than maybe one Pro Bowl. You know, so in 82, you know, not knowing what we know now, maybe Montana is Boomer Esiason. That was it. That was his one run. He never gets it done. But, you know, obviously things break differently for Montana. You know, maybe a more modern context, you know, Flacco. Maybe Flacco is currently Joe Montana in the 1982-1983 season. Yeah, he got there with that one magical run. He won it. But will he go on and do it again, or will he be a one-and-done guy? Well, that's pretty good. You know, ask Dan Fouts, ask Dan Marino, do you want to win one Super Bowl and never do it again? Of course they'd say yes. So, you know, it's the context of the times. You know, in reading the book, you can kind of even some of the quotes from some of the Niners guys that played on that team, they talk about how awful the roster was. You know, when even as guys that loved NFL, you know, Jimmy and I used to collect all those little bubblegum cards when we were kids. It was hard to remember, like, two 49er running backs from back then. You know, it was just like that wasn't a great roster. I mean, I guess I was never a Niners fan, but in writing the book, I was kind of like, God, I really respect Bill Walsh more. He was able to make a run with the squad. And there were so many young guys, and, you know, some of them ended up being great. But to weave just kind of a few veterans that had no really reputation, these young guys, and then, I mean, I hate to use it because they were NFL players, but there were some has-beens on that team. And he got them there, and he won it in 81. I mean, it made me respect Walsh more.
Yeah.
It, you know, and I want to say it's important for people to understand this. So, you know, when the 49ers are good, I mean, for the three of us and Phil growing up, I mean, when the 49ers are good, when people are like, wow, this team is running, it was weird. It's like for today, for folks, the Jacksonville to go on a run. Like if Jacksonville went on a run, for most of folks who watch football today, Jacksonville hasn't been necessarily knocking the door down. And if they went on this epic run, we would be like, where is this coming from? And it felt weird. It didn't even look right when the 49ers were looking good. It just because we were dominated by the Steelers, the Cowboys. It didn't look right.
Yeah, you're about 6 years older than us. You definitely remember those doldrum late 70s Niners teams that were nothing. And then all of a sudden,
nothing.
I mean, I think they were 2-14 in 79, and then in 81 they win the Super Bowl. Like, that's a quick turnaround. I mean, but, you know, I think you both hit on something, the lack of patience. You know, I think teams were more patient. You know, Boomer had time to try and get the Bengals back. Montana, you know, by all accounts, didn't do as well in 82 as he did in 81. Teams are more patient, you know. And one thing I think in the modern NFL, and this kind of started near the end of our time at Beloit College in the mid-90s, like, teams started giving contracts to guys that got rolled out when somebody else got injured and had one big year, you know, Scott Mitchell and stuff like that, and they got a huge contract and they never played well again. And, you know, it's even changed differently now. You know, Kevin Cobb has a couple big games for the Eagles, subbing for McNabb. He gets a big deal, you know, from Buffalo. You know, this sort of thing happens. Who was the Packers backup? The kid from LSU, Matt
Flynn.
Matt Flynn, same thing. You know, he gets a big contract from Seattle because he goes in a few games when Rodgers is hurt. He gets beat out by a third-round draft pick from Wisconsin, Russell Wilson. And then, you know, I think he went to the Raiders. He wasn't very good there. And now he was back with Green Bay and he was decent. But, I mean, it's just people, you know, you guys hit on it. Coaches don't have the timetable they used to. You know, it's a byproduct of the world we live in. We used to wait by the mailbox to get a letter from someone to see how they're doing. Now, if you don't text somebody back in like an hour, they're going ballistic. It's just, it's an impatient world. You don't have the time you used to.
I love this. It the greatest thing about the book that gave it, even when you were addressing the what ifs, which is this is the twist that just cracked me up, is the way in which you integrated your family culture into the what ifs. Like, what gave you an idea, and how did family members, how did folks react to the tone? And I could feel it because I was trying to reflect on my own family. But that was the most interesting part of the book. If you read the book, it's great. You get to know their families, and the stuff was so 70 and it in 80s. It was in the PC wasn't there. What was that like to kind of bring that part into the book? Jimmy, I'll go with you, and then Sean.
I mean, to some people, I think it was a little scary, like that. Just like people that know me kind of well, but don't really know my family, they were like, "Mother of God, like that was your childhood." But I thought it was hilarious. I mean, most of the stuff that my dad says is 100% accurate, or it's you know, I had to tone it down maybe a little bit. You know, he, but at the same time, you know, he's a great person. I mean, he's an old school. He was a hardworking guy, and he had a hard edge to him, but he would sit there and, you know, make jokes like that and, you know, suck down beers and, you know, say that Joe Montana was a wimp and, you know, other expletives I won't repeat. And, you know, you just kind of chuckled at it. And it was funny to go back and think about, like, funny stories from our childhood. And, you know, it just, I mean, you get nostalgic when you do stuff like that, but it really was like a different time period. Like, and I know like people always say that because when we get old, we become nostalgic for when we're young. But, you know, you came home, I was telling kids in class this the other day, nobody played Atari when I was little, unless it rained, because Atari sucked. The graphics yeah. weren't great. The games weren't that great. Now the video games are unbelievable. So you came home in our neighborhood, and you know, you got off the bus, and if it was spring, you were playing, you know, baseball. If it was fall, you played football, and you know, you went to high school games on Friday night. On Saturday, you know, you watched it, college games, and Sunday you played outside until the games came on, you know, in the NFL. And so it was very humorous for me to think back about, you know, some of those moments and you know, laugh about, you know, stuff that you know, we did. And, you know, so it was enjoyable. I just, you know, it was just a fun thing to do.
The Devon, the math teacher at my high school, she's an inner city girl. She grew up in Washington, D.C. She's a college basketball player. You know, she's very funny, and she, you know, her quote about the Irish is, "Y'all ain't cookie cutter people." And, you know, kind of paraphrase what she means by that is, like, nobody is going to bring, like, a family counselor to come and watch an Irish household and say, "This is how you properly conduct family business. This is good for everyone's morale. This is, like, good, you know, mentoring of, like, training kids to be adults." It's a little crazy. It's a little controversial. It's loud. But if you're watching it and you're not involved in it and you're not getting berated or, you know, told to climb up on the roof while people are throwing beer cans at you, then it's entertaining. But, you know, we managed to survive this, and, you know, we're the better for it. You know, we'll deal well with tough situations at a job or in life or whatever. But, you know, it was kind of a little homage to growing up Irish. Now, there's a lot more stories we could have weaved in there, but, you know, nobody's going to buy a book about our family, so we just weaved in a few humorous ones as we could. Now, I've got 5 brothers and sisters, and, you know, they live all over the country. And, you know, my sister in Denver, who works for the government, I guess I didn't do a good job of keeping in touch with her during this writing process, and she didn't actually – like, she had known that I was talking about writing a book, but she didn't know it was actually published. And one of my other sisters called and was like, "Oh, Lori is running out to get this book right now." And I'm like, "Really? I didn't know she was that into football since she moved to Denver." And they're like, "Oh, no, she's not. She wants to know what you wrote about our family." And I'm like, "Oh, so she's, like, worried." And they're like, "Yeah, I think she's worried that, like, you might have wrote stuff about her without her permission." And I was like, "Oh, no, she's not covered in the book, so it's all good." But, you know, so for the most part, you know, different family members that have read it, you know, my godmother, my brother, you know, they thought it was entertaining. They liked it. They thought it was good. You know, I mean, you know, my godmother, my mom's own sister, was like, I can't believe you guys were secretly tape recording your parents' dinner conversations and then playing it back later when they didn't know what the heck you were doing." I'm like, you know, we were kind of, you know, a little bit on the poverty line. We were bored. There wasn't a lot to do. You know, we talk about there was not really cable TV at the time. You know, kids had to entertain themselves more.
You know, and all right. A humorous, you know, I remember going to an Eagles game with my dad in 83, and it wasn't that cold. And he's like, here, we're walking to the vet. He's like, hold this blanket. And I'm like 9 or 10. I'm like, we don't really need a blanket. He's like, just hold the damn blanket. And you walk in and you get up to the seats, and he's like, I'll take the blanket now. And he, like, unfolds it. There was, like, a six-pack of beers in it, you know. And you look at it and start laughing, and you're like, oh, all right.
You were the bag man. He
yeah,
was having
right?
you carry the bag.
Right. So, you know.
I love it.
How it
was. We're here with Jimmy Grant, Sean Misgivens, authors of Deprived, The Lost, 1982 NFL season. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to hear about the Grant quarterback rating system. I think you got to hear this stuff. This will be good. We'll come back here in a minute.
Resistance Digital Solutions. Are you tired of running to the boys in blue? Are you done with listening to sales staff trying to upsell you technology that you don't need? We've all been there. So, what did the real sports guys do? We contacted Resistance Digital Solutions for all our technology needs. They are not there to meet sales quotas or make profit margins. They simply just want to sell you what you need at a fair price. From iPads to PCs to flat screens, TVs, or intricate home theater systems, they customize every solution based on your needs. Check out their website at www.resistancedigital.com or email them at sales@resistancedigital.com for your custom technology solutions today.
All right. This is Devon Wilson. You're listening to Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com. We're here with the authors, Jimmy Grant and Sean Misgivens, authors of Deprived, The Lost, 1982 NFL season. You can get the book at realsportsguys.com. We have a Amazon carousel. The book is there kind of spinning. Click on it. Buy it. It's a must-read. It's hilarious. And you'll learn a lot about things about the NFL that, you know, have kind of creeped up here in recent years, and you'll get a sense of that kind of the connection where some of the stuff is kind of evolved to for some folks who might be kind of joining and getting interested in the game in the last 5 to 10 years. You'll get a sense of where some of this stuff has come from and how it's evolved. But one of the interesting things about the book, and Jimmy, I'll let you jump in here, is that you developed your own rating system, and you talk about, you know, why this is different than the current systems that people use to rate quarterbacks. I wanted to give you a little bit of time to kind of talk about this, because I think I think it's important to understand that people are thinking differently about some of these things, and I think you've really kind of thought this through. So I'll let you kind of describe it.
Yeah, a number of years back, I looked at the all-time quarterback rating system. Okay, and so I started. I'll give you some choices here. You got all of us can play. Okay. Dante Culpepper, Dan Marino. Who do you like better?
I would say Dan Marino.
Okay, good. Staubach or Cutler?
Staubach.
Unitas or Gerback? Elvis Gerback. No, I know you're a Michigan guy.
Ooh. Everybody would say Unitas because he's great, but I like Gerback.
Okay.
I mean, Unitas actually statistically, but if you're just going to follow statistics, we say United.
Okay. John Elway or Kyle Orton?
Elway.
Okay. Every single one of the guys I mentioned, Culpepper is rated higher than Marino, Cutler is rated higher than Staubach, Gerbeck's rated higher than Unitas, Kyle Orton's rated higher than John Elway. I mean, I could go through the list in for eons about players that you're like, oh, my gosh, he's rated higher than, you know, Tony Eason's rated higher than Greasy. And I just looked at this, and I'm like, this is awful. Like, some of these guys that are rated so highly, they're not even, in my opinion, they weren't even good. And so what I started doing was I started looking at, well, why are they rated higher? And the rating formula, it values so many things like completion percentage and touchdown percentage and things of that nature. But what bothered me about it was the way the league's changed, it really penalizes quarterbacks who played in different eras. Because if you played prior to 78, you couldn't throw the ball away. You couldn't just roll out of the tackle box and throw it in the stand. You couldn't slide. Receivers could be manhandled down the field, and then you could be running through the secondary and a guy just clothesline you, you know. And so they're not going to even have close to those numbers. And so I started going back and thinking about, well, what is it that we value in quarterbacks? You know, what do we always talk about? And to me, it's guys who won championships. You know, guys who, you know, were clutch in the fourth quarter. And so I devised this, what my own rating system, where I took a lot of, I basically used the standard. I took the stats of the best quarterbacks, the best quarterback of each era. And, of course, you could argue who I took. You know, I used Unitas, 50s, Starr in the 60s, Bradshaw 70s, Montana 80s, Aikman 90s, I'm sorry, Aikman 2000, or 90s, and then Brady, sorry, Brady currently. Well, you could substitute Peyton Manning for Brady. It really wouldn't change the numbers that much. If you used Marino instead of, say,
Montana,
Aikman, yeah, it wouldn't change the numbers terribly. But where I, what I used was their completion percentage, yardage, the yards per completion, yards per attempt, which I think is important because nobody throws the ball down the field anymore. It's these little, you know, cheesy three-yard passes, and then the guy runs for 30 yards. Whereas, you know, back in those days, you know, in the 70s and 60s, they were launching the ball. So there were going to be more interceptions. And then I used their touchdown and their interception percentage. But I gave them points for titles, fourth quarter comebacks, and they got a bonus point if they played more of their more than half of their career before the rule changes in 78.
The bump and run rule change.
And then taking the average of those statistics, I now measure every quarterback against that on a 7 scale, and that's how you devise the rating. And so when I come up with my top 10, it's guys like Brady and Starr and Montana and Unitas and Bradshaw and, you know, guys who were clutch when they had to be, guys who won titles, not guys like, you know, no offense, I think he's a nice player, but Carson Palmer, you know, or Matt Ryan's the 11th best passer of all time. Chad Pennington's 12th. I mean, are you kidding me? Matt Schaub's 13. He might not even make an NFL roster. He's the 13th rated passer in league history. I mean, he's rated higher than Marino. I mean, it's Brett Favre. It's obscene that's how they rate quarterbacks to me. And, you know, it's really hurt some guys, in my opinion. You know, you look at a guy who recently passed, a guy like Kenny Stabler, who – I think almost anybody who knows football could make an argument that, I mean, Kenny Stabler was one of the best players of the 70s.
Yes.
And he's still waiting for an appearance in the Hall of Fame, because if you look at his quarterback rating, he's 99th all time. I mean, John Kitna's rated higher than him. I mean, if I had 2 minutes left to go in a game and I had, you know, Tony Eason standing there, who's also rated higher than him, or Kenny Stabler. I mean, is it even a question? I mean, I'd be like, hey, Tony Eason, go get Snake a Gatorade before he goes out there. You know, I mean, I hate to say that, but, you know, so I just think what we tried to look at was, you know, or what I tried to look at is what do you do in the moment, you know, when it's all out there, you know? And so that's where I think my formula is different. And the one thing I liked about it was I got some nice feedback from 2 people. Ray Didinger, who's a huge guy on the NFL Network. He's a big NFL historian. I sent him the formula, and I got a really nice response about how much he liked it and where he thought that it's really hard to compare quarterbacks across eras. But this might be a format to do that, was the gist of what he said. And he also was real happy with Starr. He thought Starr was underrated. because people said, oh, it was Lombardi and, you know, those guys that won. And you know, and then John McClain from the Houston Chronicle, I was in correspondence with him over the summer. He's trying to make a push to get Ken Sabler in the Hall of Fame, and he wanted to use my formula to talk about where Stabler rates in relation to some of these other Hall of Fame quarterbacks, because he's close. He's close. And so, you know, he thought that that might be something. He's a voter for the Hall of Fame that he might be able to bring to the table to try to help his cause. So that those were two things that I thought were you know, kind of neat about it, that some people seem to think that it has some value, at least as an alternate to the other one, you know, or a comparison.
Well, it's some good stuff. And the reason why I'm going to let folks know, you need to go and check this book out. You know, you can learn more about this rating system. You can learn more about the stories that they share about the 1982 season, about their families. There's some great stuff that have you chuckling. Gentlemen, I want to thank you for spending time with me tonight. Their book is titled Deprived, the Lost 1982 NFL Season. You can get it at on our realsportsguys.com at the website with the Amazon carousel. You click on the book, purchase it, you got to read it. Gentlemen, where can people find you if they want to follow up with you?
We have a family Facebook page. They can find me on Facebook under my wife's name, Natalie Miskimmins, so they can hit us up on Facebook through Natalie Miskimmins, N-A-T-A-L-I-E, and then the last name. I know for those listening, you're probably like, what did that guy say his name was? M-I-S-K-I-M-I-N-S, Natalie Miskimmins.
All right. And Jimmy?
If they have a question for me about the book, my email is grant2292@live.com. I'll be happy to answer any questions about the book, you know, the rating system. I don't pretend to say that it's better than other rating systems, but I think it's a good alternative, like I said.
Well, gentlemen, I know Coach George is proud. I call him Baby Shinbackler. And it was great to have an Ali Haji Sheik mentioned in there as well.
Is that a Michigan guy?
That's a Michigan guy. I remember watching when he came. I was like, yeah, he's a Michigan guy. You know, kicked those figures up. We loved him back then. Now, you know, we had King Carter back there with him. It was a great time in Ann Arbor when he was there. So loved him back there. There's some great names that y'all just had me chuckling about. And just that just brought me to tears back in those, you know, those We Are Family days in Michigan. And as a Steeler fan, I loved the way y'all talked about my Steelers. So y'all keep doing it. I hope that y'all find time to do another book. You know, I think, you know, the first time around, you learned a lot. Hopefully this will inspire you to share. And I love y'all approach to it. And hopefully, you know, you find the energy to try and take another run at it. Thank you again for being here tonight, guys, and we'll get you back on soon. No problem.
Thanks for having us, Devon.
Resistance Digital Solutions. Are you tired of running to the boys in blue? Are you done with listening to sales staff trying to upsell you technology that you don't need? We've all been there. So, what did the Real Sports Guys do? We contacted Resistance Digital Solutions for all our technology needs. They are not there to meet sales quotas or make profit margins. They simply just want to sell you what you need at a fair price. From iPads to PCs to flat screens, TVs, or intricate home theater systems, they customize every solution based on your needs. Check out their website at www.resistancedigital.com or email them at sales@resistancedigital.com for your custom technology solutions today.
Limo, Billy.
You're listening to The Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, brought to you by Resistance Digital Solutions.
LL Cool J is hot as hell. Battle anybody, I don't care, you tell. I excel, they all fail. Gonna cut down double L, my bell. I've been waiting and debating
You're listening to the Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, brought to you by Resistance Digital Solutions. You're listening to the Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, brought to you by Resistance Digital Solutions.
Well, this is good. It was a great interview with Jimmy Grant and Sean Misgivens, authors of Deprived, The Lost 1982 NFL Season. It was just good to have them in the building. They did a really good job. You know, Phil, I'm going to give you a little chance. You had to kind of sit on the sidelines and just reflect and listen. Wanted to just kind of hear some of your thoughts.
I thought it was really interesting how they came up with the idea for the book. You know, I haven't had a chance to read it yet, or I haven't read it yet, I should say. But it was really, really interesting because when they opened up the interview and they mentioned, hey, a lot of people remember the 87 strike, but the 82 strike doesn't get as much pub. And you're right, I remember that 87 strike. I remember the scabs and people crossing over, and I do remember all that. So I'll be really interested to read the book. And it also was just, it was interesting to hear the chemistry that Jimmy and Sean had in terms of just from the interview. So I'm assuming that probably came out through the book as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you can, you know, they're great storytellers, and, you know, the family aspect of how they brought that into it to provide a context was an interesting angle to it. And, you know, the rating system that that Jimmy developed, I think as he talked about, placed value where I don't think folks have kind of placed value that they kind of, you know, you can contextualize what somebody's done. And just not have it about, you know, the stats, that all of it has a context to it, and trying to capture the context, I think has really elevated, you know, some of the quarterbacks that, you know, I think most people would place some value in. You know, when you think about what they talked about, you know, how would you, I mean, you think about some of the labor stuff today, some of the Brady stuff, and just the kind of ongoing contention that was obviously part of that 57-day strike. How do you see, do you see some of that stuff continuing, and how do you view that as, you know, in terms of the future of the NFL? Because I see some of those similar things still being issues, but it's just the scale is different today because of the money. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, so I believe the strike that we just went through, 2012, maybe 2013, that was a lot different than the strikes back in 87 and 82, because as fans, we, you know, based on the 7 ESPN channels and the 55 regional sports channels, we felt a lot more connected. You know, we learned about things closer to real time, where 25, 30 years ago, things were much, much different in terms of how we got our information. So I think also the players had a lot more leverage now, because players had more informal platforms to speak out on things like Twitter and also the internet, where those weren't resources that they had 25 or 30 years ago. I think the other big difference between the strike we just had and the 82 and 87 strike is that football was not the giant that it is now. It was certainly one of the big sports in the country, but I think it was behind baseball at that time or pretty close. And also, the sports, the NFL wasn't as advertising and non-football fan friendly as it is now. Back then, where back then you pretty much had hardcore fans and a smaller percentage of the population who were not hardcore fans followed football. Now, I would argue that the non-football hardcore fans probably outnumber the football, quote-unquote, purists, because football has such more of an entertainment value. You have more legalized gambling. You have fantasy football. You have all these different broad things that have brought people to watch football, where maybe they didn't grow up with football or they didn't play football growing up. So those are some dynamics that I think that are different. So to me, that adds value to what Jimmy and Sean did with this book, because there's probably a lot of stories and a lot of things from the interviews they were able to pull in that maybe never saw the light of day in terms of through the national media.
Yeah, and you know, and it's funny, like even going back and in their book talking about people like Joe Montana before they were great, you know, when they were in a process that, you know, people didn't quite know that they were gonna become that person. And you know, I almost feel like that with someone like a Russell Wilson, where he's having some success, but he's living that kind of criticism. People aren't sure whether or not he is that person. And you see some of that today where, you know, maybe 10 years from now, folks might be like, what were we thinking about? But it's hard for people who kind of, you know, see these commercials of Joe and some of these people now to know that there was some period of uncertainty. And the idea of the 49er franchise, you know, when I said, you know, the Jacksonville thing, it was true. I mean, when people were talking about the 49ers, I remember people were like, oh, the 49ers. I was like, what are you talking about? You know, because not everybody had access to TV like they do or information now, like you kind of pointed out. And, you know, I had to kind of make some special arrangements to kind of see some of these games. And when they were out, like the 49ers, I mean, it was like if someone was saying Jacksonville's on the rise. I mean, you'd be like, are you crazy? You know, or the Jets, you know, going on a Super Bowl run. You'd be like, these folks are crazy. That whole notion of it is hard for people to kind of understand, and this kind of role of development. And I love the way they answer the question of how hard it is today, but it doesn't mean that it's not necessary, you know. And I guess only the coaches and organizations that have security can actually do it, you know. So Seattle can do that, you know, maybe, or other organizations. But the idea of needing to let somebody develop is still a necessary thing, as I was saying earlier to RG3. And so, you know, that was kind of an interesting part about it when you start to compare, you know, that era to this era and what produced greatness. And even people like Plunkett and Anderson, who had this resurgence late in their career, I was like, can that happen today? Can that, can you have a Kenny Anderson or a Plunkett today? I mean, could that, who would be the Kenny Anderson or Plunkett today? I couldn't even think of it.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's amazing. Well, hey, check them out. They're on the realsportsguys.com website. We have an Amazon .com carousel. Their book is kind of spinning around there. Click on it. It's called Deprived, The Lost 1982 NFL Season. Really, really loving it. I want to hit you up, and we kind of talked about this a little bit off air and then kind of hit into a little bit I hit into it, my little rant. This RG3 thing, man, I'm trying to understand it. To criticize Daniel Snyder, but I thought about it on my way home. This isn't a Daniel Snyder issue. This is the football operations people. This is like, you know, just kind of listening to Jimmy and Sean, I'm kind of back in this. This is the football operations people, you know, messing up. Yeah, you know, he got some ownership in this, but where do you go if you that organization, man? When you see that situation, what are you thinking about? Like, what do you deduce from that?
Well, you know, we were kind of talking about this offline, and my perspective is slightly different. I feel that sometimes things just blow up. They just go bad, and it's not necessarily somebody's fault. So if you looked at RG3 after his first season, everything looked great, okay? They went to the playoffs. I believe they lost in the first round, but they made the playoffs with a rookie quarterback. They won 10 games, or like at least 10 games. And RG3 was looking like a rising star. He made the Pro Bowl. And the Redskins looks very justified picking up, like making all these moves to get that pick from St. Louis. It made sense that they mortgaged away their future to get a guy like this. I remember even listening to Sports Talk Radio at the time. I forget what show it was, but they had polled all 32 or 31 other GMs and had asked, you know, hey, would you have given, like, knowing what you know now, RG3 had this great year, would you have mortgaged your future like the Redskins did, knowing that you would be getting a player like RG3? And in that poll, it was something like 90% of the GMs that responded said yes. So to me, we have to keep things in perspective. How often do you have a Pro Bowl quarterback in his first year all of a sudden just dud out like RG3 has? It doesn't happen often. You know, there may be a listener out there that can pull one or two examples out. But out of the, you know, that's not many. So in my opinion, that means that it doesn't happen often. And sometimes things go bad. And that's what happened with RG3. And I don't necessarily think there's anybody to blame. It just went bad.
And you, when you look at that class, I mean, you got RG3, Blackman, and Trent Richardson, which I don't even understand that. I mean, and I said at the time, I was like, you know, something about these Alabama running backs. Lacey's kind of proved me wrong, but I think I was kind of critical at the time. We go back and check the tape. But I didn't think it was going to be as hard of a fall. And that class, when you start putting it in context, I mean, other than, you know, Luck, and then I think with the offensive lineman that they had that was drafted there, you know, I don't know, you have to me top five draft that kind of have that kind of result. So he's not the only one in that draft that, you know, top five group that's struggling. There must have been something in the water. You know, maybe something they had that night that just is turning things off. But it's crazy. You know, we didn't get into this. As you preparing for the NFL season, I know we did our predictions, but a lot has happened up until this point. You know, as you get ready, and we'll probably get into it here in our next podcast, you know, either before or after the opening week, you know, what are some of the storylines, or what have you been getting excited about as the league is starting that, from your own observation?
Well, I'm curious to see what happens in Seattle. There's been the last two seasons, things have been pretty calm for them. And now with everything that's going on with Russell Wilson, with his contract, and you know, my man's talking about there's this water that cured his concussion, and he's also an owner with this, and there's a lot of extra noise that's coming from that camp. So I'm curious to see how the team responds. Also, there's a handful of players who have been plagued by injury over the last few years. And I'm curious to know if they are over the hill or if it was just a blip. And so one example is Calvin Johnson, Megatron.
Mm-hmm.
You know, getting ready for fantasy football drafts, and half of the folks the pundits that are putting together the primers are pretty much saying that he's done. But then there's another half that's saying, yes, he's still the top wide receiver out there. So to me, he's a big gamble right now from a fantasy football perspective, but just from an overall football perspective of the guy. He's a Detroit Lion. Our hometown team, our home state team, as well as he just seems like a decent guy. And I'm really looking forward to see if Detroit can make the move forward, but it really hinges on his health.
Yeah, I'm with the announcement of Tyrod Taylor, I had a chance to watch him at Virginia Tech. And I just think he's got a swag about him. And I think Buffalo's a right. I still like, again, E.J. Manuel. I liked him coming out of college. I felt like in the right situation he could grow. But, again, I think, like you said, sometimes it's just being matched with the right thing. But I think given what Rex wants to do and his leadership skills, it's going to be interesting to see how he fits and what he gives them in terms of the athleticism. And he just has like this kind of quiet confidence that I like about him. My Steelers, I'm a Tomlin fan, but he's got his Super Bowl, but I think that he's almost in one of those that space where they need to start making another run, and they've had some incidents and some suspensions and some injuries and some things, and I really feel like offensively they're where they need to be, and they got some young defensive players, and that's a tough division. But I picked them to come out of it because I think that Ben is ready. He got the weapons around him to lead, and that them youngins will get better defensively as they go. Thinking about some of the people that kind of under the radar. San Diego made a really good run last year, they kind of solidify the running back position this year, and everybody's talking about Denver, but they kind of got that solid team, and got Rivers under contract, kind of seeing what's going to happen over out there and how that might shape the run in the AFC, and that's something that I'm really interested in seeing, and then the whole NFC East is like a. It's just like a whole bunch of soap opera stuff happening there. And I don't know where to go with it. It's just you got Philly, you got this stuff in Washington. And then the Giants are just kind of sitting there quietly. Not really a lot of stuff coming out of there. They had a couple things early on, but, they're kind of settling in to it. And then Dallas is right there. But that is just that's just a mess. And then something's got to happen. And so I think there's a lot of interesting storylines in there. And with all this mess, nobody's talking about Jay Cutler in Chicago. It's like he's the quiet one, that nobody – he was the person everybody's talking about. He kind of just been behind the scenes a little bit. Maybe that's good for him, but something's got to give in Chicago. He either got to step up or step out with that. So, we're getting ready for the season, and then college football season starting. And I know we didn't talk about our and I think, unlike others, we might wait for the season to get warmed up a little bit. But I'm excited about this kind of Wisconsin-Alabama lineup. We got Michigan against Utah this weekend. We got some good football, that college football coming together. Game day is going to be coming out a little bit. So I'm excited for the beginning of that season. Have you lined up your college football stuff? Or are you still in the lab thinking about it?
I'm still in the lab with, I am not really prepared right now with college football.
Yeah.
All I know is Ohio State, being in Ohio State, it has been insufferable. The fans, because they're the first team to ever be unanimously the top team in the AP poll. And even fantasy football, man, I'm so far behind. I have a couple of drafts this coming weekend. So it may just be boot camp.
You missed the preparation. What's going on, man? You always ready for the draft. Like you've already run your analysis. You got your board up in the house. What's going on, man?
Well, I tell you what, that may be it, but also part of it is intentional because last year I did at least 10 mock drafts, okay? Mm. I started a month before the season, maybe six weeks before the season. And in the league that means the most to me, which is Eric Hamilton's league, the guru from the fantasy guru from KZoo, I did not make the playoffs.
Oh, my God.
And that's the first time, I believe, in that league I have not made the playoffs. And so what happens is if you don't make the playoffs in his league, you have to go to the JV division the next year with everybody else who did not make the playoffs, with the six guys that did not make the playoffs. So it's embarrassing, man. So, like, my approach has been different this year where it's like I'm only going to do one mock draft, maybe the day of or the day before the draft, because I feel like last season I was too prepared and I was, like, I just outsmarted myself.
So you just, I just going to, and I was going to let the music, because you were on a roll. You know, I was going to let it play out. You know, let you close this thing out. You know, I'm going to go to the corner because it felt like you were in a therapy session. So I thought I'd just put a little music there. Let you have the last word on this one because, you know,
it was horrible,
like, you know, they used to do it easy. I'm going to let you have the last word on this because it seemed like you just got to get something off your chest.
Well, like I mentioned, I'm in the JV division this year, and it's embarrassing. It is very, very embarrassing. It's embarrassing, but I'm just going to put my head down and get it done, period. And everybody else out there listening, if you had a bad fantasy football season, just know that it doesn't mean that you are incompetent. It doesn't mean that you didn't, like, you aren't smart. It just means that you had a bad season. So don't let it be a bad two seasons. That's all I got.
And I'll say, as a person who started out my first commissioner role, and I was sitting in my team, my draft went crazy because I was trying to focus on being a commissioner. I think I went like 0-5, close wins, high scoring, and made a run for the playoffs. I understand. And this year, I'm like, I gotta bounce back. So you're right. Don't take it too bad. Just get better.
Yep.
Get better. But remember, you are what your record says you are. Until next time, this is Real Sports Guys, y'all. Thank you, Jimmy and Sean, for being with us. We'll see you next time.